everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. I really love feeling the energy of this community that cares about healthy, nutritious food. We all want it, don't we? Even those people that don't even know they want it because it makes us feel good. It makes us feel energized. And why shouldn't we have a long life, a long quality life? Quality, key word. There are a lot of people here that are living longer lives, but they're not really quality lives. And that's part of what we talk about here on It's All About Food, feeling good. It's important. Life should be experienced in the best way it can, with joy, without aches and pains, lots of energy, and we do that by eating wonderful food that's delicious and nutritious. Okay, so about a month ago, we talked about the new FDA ban on trans fats that's in the works, and when I spoke about it, I got an email from someone that we will be talking to in just a moment, Emilia Leonardo. She's a principal consultant with Leonardo StatRegulatory Associates, advising and lecturing on ingredient safety and FDA regulatory requirements. She brings over 30 years of professional experience, and from 2012 to 2015, Dr. Leonardo served as Vice President of Consumer Product Safety and Science Policy at the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And at the GMA, she led programs to modernize the generally recognized as safe program and managed emerging ingredient issues, including partially hydrogenated oils and trans fats. And we're going to learn more about that right now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Emilia.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for contacting me and wanting to give us perhaps a little more clarity.
Yes, I'd like to speak to you about hydrogenated oils. There are two types. Hydrogenated oils contain trans fats. And trans fats are formed from vegetable oils through a partial hydrogenation, and they're also naturally occurring.
They are naturally occurring?
Yes, they're from ruminant animals such as cows. You can find trans fats naturally occurring in beef and dairy products and cheese. And I'll discuss both. And I'd like to begin with the industrial produced trans fats first. As everyone knows, November 8th of 2013, FDA published their tentative determination that partially hydrogenated oils, or otherwise known as referred to as PHOs, are no longer considered generally recognized as safe, or GRAS. And on June 16th of this year, FDA finalized this determination and has given industry until June of 2018 to transition out of PHOs. They have also indicated that industry has the opportunity to file a food additive petition where FDA will review the information and make a determination what uses and use levels will be considered safe and can be used in food. So what are PHOs? They're produced from a number of sources such as soybean, cottonseed, coconut, canola, palm kernels, sunflower, or blends of these oils. They have a really very nice shelf stability, and they can be subjected to very high temperatures, especially for commercial frying temperatures, and they don't break down very easily. They improve flavor profile and the texture of many products. You can control the partial hydrogenation process, which produces the trans fats. So you could either dial it up to have a great deal of trans fats, and that produces the hardness, the hard oils and shortenings, or it can be low levels where you'll see that in a lot of the oils.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is to discuss the history of why are PHOs in our food to begin with. It was used in the U.S. for a very long time. It's been in the food supply for over 70 years. It was developed in the 1930s, and they were originally used to replace saturated fats such as butter and lard. And in, during World War II, the U.S. government really pushed the use of partially hydrogenated oils because they were stable, especially for rations for the military, and animal products were scarce. And so PHO started to become, you know, rather, you know, introduced into the food supply.
Everybody had a container of Crisco in their cabinet.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. And it fried foods well, and so everybody used them. In fact, in 1959, Eleanor Roosevelt made a commercial for a margarine company advocating the use of margarine over butter because it was believed to be healthier. And you can find, if the readers are interested, you can actually find that commercial on YouTube. It exists today.
All right, I'll look for that and link it to this interview. That sounds like fun.
It was also determined to be generally recognized as safe by a committee that was commissioned by the FDA. It was called the Select Committee on Gras Substances, or SCOGS, and they confirmed the gras status of soybean in approximately 1976. And then PHOs increased in the 1980s to replace tropical oils. Because PHOs were considered safer and better for you because they were low in saturated fats. Even the Center for Science and the Public Interest, also known as CSPI, advocated for the use of PHOs over that of saturated fats. And as such, PHOs just became ubiquitous. They were used everywhere. And as the use of PHOs increased, data started coming in suggesting that maybe it's not as wonderful as we thought it was. Maybe it's not better than saturated fats. And by the late 1990s, data did confirm that high levels of trans fats were associated with increased levels of LDLs, which is the bad cholesterol, and decreased levels of HDL, which is the good cholesterol. In 1999, FDA began to investigate these cardiovascular events. And in 2003, they published a draft ruling regarding trans fats. And they finalized that rule in 2006. And that requiring the manufacturers to label products containing more than 0.5 grams per serving of trans fat. So if it's a half a gram, it needed to be on the label. If it wasn't on the front panel where you see trans fat amount, if it was under 0.5 grams, you would see it in the ingredient listing. And that's the way it is today. And I strongly recommend everyone to read your labels.
Yeah, well, I want to interject here. One of the important reasons why you want to do that, if you really want to avoid trans fats, if you see partially hydrogenated oil in the ingredient list, you know it's there, even though in the nutrient label it says it's not there. And so if you have a serving that's bigger than the recommended serving size, you're going to get more than half a gram.
That's correct, and that was a concern that the FDA expressed. In 2004, and again in 2009, FDA received two citizen petitions, one from the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and another from Dr. Fred Kumerow, who's now a centenarian. He's a professor from the University of Illinois, and they asked the FDA to remove the gras status of industrial produced PHOs, which contain the trans fats. In 2013, Dr. Kumerow decided to sue the FDA because he believed that FDA had an unreasonable delay for not responding to the petition. And he's asked the court to compel a ban on PHOs. That was the impetus for FDA to issue their tentative determination. And it's because they say there's no longer a consensus among the experts that PHOs are generally recognized as food in human food based upon the current scientific data.
Therefore, is there a consensus?
No, there's not a consensus that PHOs are safe. Some scientists say yes at certain levels, and some scientists say no. And to have the GRAS specification, you need to have, you must not have a severe conflict among the experts. You don't need to have total consensus, but you really cannot move forward with GRAS if there's a severe conflict. And the FDA believes there is a severe conflict, and therefore the GRAS specification doesn't exist. But they had the door open for a food additive petition. And so in order for a food additive petition to be approved, it actually shifts the onus to the industry to submit scientific evidence as part of the food additive petition, establishing uses and levels for which a reasonable certainty of no harm will result from the uses and the levels of PHOs. Now, food additive petition would focus on very low incidental uses, low levels of such as emulsifiers, pan-release agents, color and flavor carriers. And it's going to take FDA about 2 years to review, and the decision is FDA's. The petition will be public. So if there's interested parties who want to review the petition and the data and they want to make a comment, they're free to do so. That FDA will put it up on their website. It's available through Freedom of Information. But I wanted to talk about also is the decrease in PHOs in the food supply. In 2000, there was 8 billion pounds of PHOs sold to manufacturers in the United States. Today, that number is slightly above 1 billion pounds, and it continues to decrease. It's difficult to reformulate some products because there's replacement oils are not always necessarily available, or they don't provide the characteristics that the product requires for a consumer to be happy with. For example, there was one company who reformulated a biscuit. They reformulated relatively quickly. It took them about 3 years to do so. No one would buy the product because they didn't like the way it tasted or the sensation of the product. It turned out to be more like a hockey puck. When they spent the time, it took them a little greater than 5 years to replace it with suitable oils that provided the textures that consumers want. It's still on the market today. Everything is fine.
So it just took a little time to formulate the product to make it better without partially hydrogenated oils.
Right. See, with partially hydrogenated oils, it's one-stop shopping. You can dial up the amount of trans fat or dial it down according to the needs of the product. Without partially hydrogenated oils, you need to go and find a suitable oil. The most difficult are the hard oils, or the hard fats, and so they tend to switch out, relatively quickly to saturated fats, such as palm oils, or lard or butter, to animal products, which
each one of those ingredients has their own issues, political and health related issues. Palm oil, a lot of people are up in arms about the rainforest being destroyed because we're using so much palm oil, and then those of us who care about animals are not going to support the use of lard or butter.
Absolutely. And for someone who doesn't eat animal products, there were products that I bought that I was very happy with because they contained vegetable oils. And now I no longer purchase them because they contain lard. So it's very, very important to read labels. But industry has done a good job in reducing the amount of PHOs in the food supply, and they've reduced the amount by 86% since 2003, and they continue to do so. And the consumer, though, needs to take responsibility. They don't want to eat PHOs, read the labels very carefully.
Yeah, it is to a large degree up to us. Now, I know that many of us like to paint government-related organizations and in large manufacturing organizations as evil and as doing whatever they can to maximize profits. And that may or may not be true. It may be true to some degree. But the thing here, when you're talking about the history of this one particular ingredient, we can see that things take a long time, and took a long time to build up the use of this product, and now it's going to take a while to wean off of the product. I would love to see the government work faster, but it's got its own challenges, financial and political, to do so. So do you eat partially hydrogenated oils now that you know what you know about them?
I subscribe really to Dr. Esselstyn's plant-based diet, and I try to avoid oils at all, as much as possible.
Okay, well that's a really good answer.
But again, it's up to the person. People need to be responsible, and as your program, responsible living, people need to be responsible and make the right choices, for themselves.
Yeah, it
What
certainly
I
helps when we're knowledgeable about it, but when we're talking about food in the healthy school lunch program and foods marketed to children and foods marketed to people who aren't focused on food and they're just grabbing something because it's there or it's inexpensive or whatever, they need better oversight.
Yes, and the levels of PHOs have significantly decreased and they continue to decrease. One of the things that I wanted to call to the listeners' attention is naturally occurring trans fats. This is something that's been missed. I don't think people understand that trans fats exist. In animal products. So there are, through the digestive process, ruminant animals produce trans fats. You find it in cheese, butter, dairy products, beef, goats. And it's estimated that people consume about 1.2 grams a day of these trans fats. So if you're interested in,
If they're
I'm
eating
sorry.
animal foods, right?
If they're eating animal foods, yes, I'm
Yeah.
talking about the USDA general database for the average consumer. And although there's some data that says that it's not as harmful as industrial produced vegetable trans fats, as a toxicologist, I'm not convinced that there is a difference between naturally occurring trans fats in terms of risk versus the industrial produced vegetable oil trans fats. It's also very important to note that in the USDA database, there are non-ruminant animals that they say contain trans fats. And I'm like, how can this be? How can you find trans fats in chicken, pork, eggs, fish? And then after digging a little more, it's actually because these mega farms feed these animals repurposed human food. They also it's also found in animal feed. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you eat dairy, beef, or any other kinds of animals, you're still going to be exposed to trans fats. The only way forward to move forward without consuming trans fats is a whole foods vegan diet. And even if you are vegan, you need to be careful because if you do buy processed foods, read the labels because it may contain pH, partially hydrogenated oils. The information is not hidden. It's there on the label. Just read the labels.
Now, this is just one ingredient. One ingredient, partially hydrogenated oil, one ingredient. But my understanding is there are over 9,000 known additive ingredients that we are assuming are safe.
If you're talking about the generally recognized as safe, the Pew Charitable Trust and NRDC did come up with that number. I've never seen that number or the data behind the development of that number. I think it's a little inflated. But the generally recognized as safe criteria allows for an industry representative or a group of experts to determine the safety of an ingredient. Now, this law has been in effect for well over 50 years, allowing the generally recognized as safe process to occur. It's undergoing modernization right now. There's a five-part modernization strategy where it brings more visibility to the process. I agree. I'm also a consumer. I want to know what's in my food. I want to ensure that my food is safe. But we also have to remember that the FDA does a very good job, and we do have one of the safest food supplies in the world because FDA does its job. And a company does not have any advantage or benefit from trying to put harmful ingredients in their food. Hopefully with the modernization process that is ongoing, they'll bring more transparency and improve consumer trust in the process.
I think the FDA's biggest challenge is funding, from what I'm understanding. And when you say modernization, are you talking about the Food Safety Modernization Act?
Oh, no. I'm referring to modernization of the generally recognized as safe procedure. This has been a voluntary industry effort. It was led by GMA, but it is a industry effort working with a number of the NGOs as well as bringing FDA into the fold. They're developing a public standard that will be very transparent and visible during the process to ensure that everyone conducts the general recognized as safe criteria in the same consistent manner, and it's done with very high quality. Seated on this committee are 32 scientists from across the sectors, including NGOs, the Humane Society sits on it. There's the former NRDC person who sits on there. The CSPI also sits on there. There are some industry members. There's some government involved as well. So its broad spectrum is going to be very public, and it's going to develop a standard, a process, specification on how GRAS reviews should be conducted. They're also developing a database for the self-determined ingredients to be placed into this database, so it brings more visibility. And I believe that if they do a better job in grassroots movements to educate the consumer what they're doing and taking the time to listen, I think it's essential that people in industry listen to what the consumer wants. You can't guess because you may not, you won't give the consumer what they want, they're not going to buy it. You really need to hear what the consumer concerns are and address those concerns.
Well, I think what we can do is what you mentioned before, since there are many other ingredients that are allowed in the food system and they may be generally recognized as safe, we don't know if they're going to go down the same path as partially hydrogenated oils as we learn more about them. The best way to avoid as many of them as we can is to eat a whole foods, plant-based diet and stay away from anything in a box like Jacqueline recommended. Anything that, if man made it, don't eat it. Now, what's curious to me, Amelia, is that you've been involved in ingredient safety and government regulations for a long time, and you're a vegan?
Yes, I try to follow the vegan pathway as much as possible when I'm on the road. Many times, inadvertently, I become a vegetarian, but I try to follow the vegan. My family, my husband eats vegan with me during the week. When he's not with me, I don't know if he eats the same diet, but when I'm cooking, we clearly eat vegan at home.
And love when vegetables. When did this get started for you? How long have you been doing this, and how did you turn on to this way of eating?
I started maybe about 25 years ago when I was working at the more than that. It was over 30 years ago when I was working at the Cleveland Clinic, and my sister married into the Kreil family, which is and so did Dr. Esselstein. And he
Kreil.
Talked about don't eat anything with the face and having compassion for animals. I really stopped eating red meat, but I continued to eat chicken until I passed a vehicle one day that had cages and cages of chickens. And when I saw this, I could no longer eat poultry. So I stopped eating meat, and it's not only for health reasons, but primarily for compassion. I am a very committed to treating animals with respect and the welfare of animals. I am involved in animal rescue, and I can't eat them. They're here. God put them here just like he put us, and I want to share the earth with them.
Well, it's very exciting to hear that someone who's been involved with all kinds of federal regulations and food safety is actually on the path that you are on. And I'm wondering, in the decades that you've been eating this way, what the reaction has been to you, or did they even know about it when you've served on different committees and you've been with the Grocery Manufacturers Association? How did they respond to your food choices?
Well, I've not had any problem. They all know my dietary habits. There was always, a meal of my choosing available for me.
Nice.
Again, this is America, land of the free, and people have free choice. And they choose to eat their way. I choose to eat my way. And hopefully one day they'll see that my way is the best way.
I hope so, too. Well, let's end on that nice thought, shall we?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you, Amelia. Thanks for sending me your very kind messages and your notes, and I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing, too.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. Amelia Leonardo. And I think that was a very interesting conversation. So it's not black and white. It's not good and bad. There's a lot of gray in the middle. And the best way we can navigate our food system is to concentrate on whole foods, plant-based, and organic. And while you digest that thought, we'll take a little break. Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to part two of It's All About Food. Okay, before I get to some of the things I wanted to cover, I wanted to bring you to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. On the right-hand side, I want you to take a look at what's at the top there. I wanted to let you know about a free webinar. I think it's an hour-long webinar called The Secrets of Effortless Mind Meditation, How to Eliminate Anxiety and Gain Deep Peace with Ease. Now, this is a free program. It's going to take place on July 30th in 9 days, and it's with the founder of Effortless Mind, Ajayan Boris. You may remember him. I interviewed him maybe a year ago. He has a book out called Effortless Mind, Meditate with Ease. I really enjoyed speaking with him, loved his book, and I can't say enough about meditation, and I don't say enough about it because most of the time I'm talking about food on this program. It's all about food. But I think that the mind is an important piece, not only to how we digest our food, it is connected to that too, but a lot of our health and well-being has to do with what we're saying to ourselves and all kinds of things that are going on in our mind that we think we don't have control of, but we do have control of. And in meditation, we learn how to think the way we want to think and focus on the feelings we want to have, joy and happiness and peacefulness, rather than anxiety and fear, things like that. So I just wanted to bring your attention to this free seminar. Now, I believe there will probably be some solicitation at the end of the seminar for a longer workshop, but I'm sure there'll be lots of wonderful information in this free webinar on July 30th. I'm going to be tuning in, and I hope you do too. To find out more about it, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and just scroll down to the right where it says free one-hour webinar. Okay? Great. Now I can cross that off my list. If you want to know more about Ajayan Boris, the person who's leading this program, there is an interview that I had with him at Responsible Eating and Living, so you could put his name in the search bar on my website and listen to that interview. Fabulous. Now we'll all be anxiety-free. We'll have nothing to worry about with regards to all the crazy things that are going on in our food system, like, for example, some crazy stuff that's going on about kale. Have you heard the rumors about kale? That there's a chemical called, are you ready for this? Thallium in kale. I just heard this, and I've been reading a number of different articles about it. I have to say that I'm rather disappointed because Mother Jones magazine, the writer, journalist Tom Philpott, is somebody that I normally respect, and I love some of the articles he's put out in that magazine. This one, I'm not so sure. I don't think he's dug deep enough, but basically in the article in Mother Jones, he's talking about, well, the title of the article is Sorry Foodies, We're About to Ruin Kale, and he's talking about a person, Ernie Hubbard, who has been noticing some odd trend among some of his clients in Marin County, and he's been linking some of their health issues with the fact that they're consuming kale, and he found thallium in blood samples, and he's now saying that kale is bad. Kale contains thallium. And it's really not a fair conclusion. You know, you could have a bunch of clients, and they all come in and say they're feeling one way or another, and you could ask them a variety of questions, and you can say, are you breathing? And they can say, yes, I breathe. And then, you know, you could correlate that all the people that had a particular issue are also breathing. That doesn't mean that breathing causes that issue. Are you following me? There's been no clinical studies. There's been no science behind this, just some guy saying a few people have thallium in their blood and he's linking it to kale. I don't think this is a reason for any kind of scare, and there's nothing that's been proven. And I'm just sorry that it made it all the way to Mother Jones and scaring people about this wonderful, wonderful food. There's a great article, and I'll have links to all of these different articles on this program when it's in the archives. But on Vox.com, they kind of go over all the things that are wrong in this claim about kale being bad for you. The article is called "The Viral Idea That Kale is Bad for You is Based on Incredibly Bad Science." And the one thing that I really appreciated that they highlighted in this article is this. Blaming a single food item for a vast array of health problems is one of the hallmarks of a crackpot health theory. And I want to say that not only is blaming a single food for a vast array of health problems a hallmark of a crackpot health theory, also promoting a single food item, saying that it's going to take care of all health problems, is also a hallmark of a crackpot health theory. Now, I love kale, and I know that I like to say that there's nothing kale can't do, but I don't really mean that. I don't think it can cure all ills. It just can support a healthy immune system. There are more things that are involved with each and every one of us in our health. I encourage the consumption highly of dark leafy green vegetable, not just kale, collards, charred spinach, bok choy, watercress, parsley, basil, anything that's dark and green, arugula, lovely, flavorful, and of course, make it organic. Now, it is true that if a plant is grown in soil that is contaminated with toxic metals, with toxins, the plant may be able to pull that up through its root system and contain it within its own cells. For example, at Responsibility and Living, we did a Real Good News and Review report on chocolate. And there are places, unfortunately, where chocolate, cocoa, contains a high degree of cadmium and or lead. And there's been more focus on this these days. And it's because the soils where those particular cocoa beans are grown is contaminated. We've also heard stories about rice, unfortunately, a rice containing arsenic. And this is something to be aware of. It's not something to get all crazy about, though. And the reports that have come out with Consumer Reports, as an example, tell us that there are some brands of rice and some varieties of rice that are better than others. And I recommend checking that out. If you want, you can email me at info@realmeals.org, and I'll send you a link to those articles that tell you which kinds of rice are better to eat than others. I personally stick to the California varieties of basmati rice. Those are lower on the arsenic scale than the Texas and Arkansas varieties. And the other point is eating a very varied diet. We want to eat lots of different foods, and it's important for lots of reasons. Now, too much of anything is not good. Too much water. We could drown by drinking too much water. So we have to be really careful about the stuff that's in the news, and I just wanted to point out that this thing is going viral about kale. So if you hear somebody complaining about kale because of this reason, or you've read this guy Hubbard's article and you're concerned about it, I recommend going to the Vox.com site and reading the article, "The Viral Idea That Kale is Bad for You is Based on Incredibly Bad Science." This will give you all the talking points you need to put your mind at ease about kale. Okay? We love kale. I love kale. I personally believe kale saved my life, and I'm sticking to it. I'm continuing to consume a bit of kale almost every day in my green juices, in salads. Kale is a lovely, lovely food. Do I have anything more to say about that? Let me look in my notes. Yeah, I just want to underline organic is better, but this particular issue isn't really about whether the plant is grown organically. It's about whether the soil or the fertilizer that's put on the soil is contaminated with thallium. I hope we don't hear any more on this. Okay, that's my kale for you. And you may also, this is not exactly the same subject, but you may want to refer to, if you haven't seen these two different articles already, there's the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen Plus, where they list 12 ingredients that are highly contaminated with hazardous pesticides, and they recently added the plus to the Dirty Dozen, adding two more, leafy greens, kale and collard greens, because they found that they're also contaminated with insecticides, toxic to the human nervous system. This is when they are industrially grown, conventional kale, and the recommendation is to buy organic. Now, Consumer Reports also came out with a great report called Crop to Table back in May, and they say in their report that in the U.S., conventional kale, industrial-grown kale, is a medium risk for toxins, if not organic, and if grown in the United States, medium risk, and a low risk from Mexico if it's conventional, not organic. So there's that. Whew! Oh, kale. My friend kale. Now, I wanted to move over to, just briefly, while I'm still on the kale subject, all the wonderful things that you can do with kale. When I'm doing my private health coaching, so often I find that the solution to many people's issues, and there are so many of them, are resolved when they include more dark leafy green vegetables in their diet. It's really that simple. For some people, it's hard because they don't like the bitter flavor of greens. And the best way to ease into eating dark leafy greens is with smoothies. I like to, with my smoothies, use three ingredients, a green, some kind of fat like coconut, avocado, raw nuts, and seeds, and a fruit like berries. Now, you can add a lot more ingredients to that, but that's like the secret formula because the fruit, preferably berries, which are high in antioxidants and lower in sugar than other really sweet fruits, helped to make the kale go down, helped to make the medicine go down, helped to make the good bitter greens go down in the most delightful way. And the fat is important. Whole fat from plant foods is important because the vitamins in the dark leafy greens are fat soluble and they need a little fat to help them get absorbed into the system. So you combine these three wonderful ingredients, fruit, fat, and greens, blend it up with water or your favorite non-dairy milk, and you have a delicious and nutritious way to get your greens. And then as you get used to the flavor, the more leaves of greens that you can add to your smoothie, the better. And then there's sauteed greens. I think for those that are easing into the world of dark leafy greens, smoothies for raw greens and sauteed greens for cooked greens are the way to enter into this world. It's important to eat them both raw and cooked because cooking the greens makes the nutrients more absorbable. And yet when we eat foods raw, we're getting all kinds of wonderful nutrition, so it's good to do it both ways. And I recommend easing into eating greens, sauteing them, Now, you can use a tiny little bit of oil if you need to. It's not necessary. But if it helps you eat the greens, then use a little. And you can saute onions, a little garlic, add in your greens, saute them around. It's delicious. If you don't like onions or garlic or you're looking for a little different taste, you might saute ginger and then add your greens. That's a really fabulous combination. You can always squeeze a little lemon juice on top, and you have some wonderful food. If you need specifics on how to do these things, you can go to, everyone together, responsibleeatingandliving.com, go to the recipe tab, scroll down to sides and greens, and you'll see some really specific recipes on how to cook greens. Another great way is to just throw some greens into any kind of soup just before you're about to eat it. Just let them cook quickly and soften. You can blend them all together so that you don't even see them if you don't think you're going to like them. But I encourage you to get your greens. And I do have a four-part food show on greens called It's All About Greens at Responsible Eating and Living. I show you how to do a smoothie. I show you how to juice and why you want to and what's the difference between juicing and blending. People always get confused about the two and want to know what the benefit is of one versus the other. I think it's a very individual thing. Sometimes both are fine. Sometimes one is better than the other. It really depends on who you are and what your objectives are. And then cooking greens and then using greens in salads. And in the summertime especially, well, I love kale salad and dark green salads all year long, but they stay a long time. They travel really well. They don't wilt. So if you're going to a potluck or a picnic or something, you can prepare your kale salad, and it won't be all soggy and limp when you get to the event, even in warm weather. But the key is, I believe, is massaging your kale with whatever dressing you're going to use. This will help get the leaves nice and soft and tender and making you want to gobble it up right away. Good. Okay. Another article I wanted to bring to your attention. You know, there, just like this kale story, there's somebody out there who says something, and he's got some credible education behind him and has a slick little website and sounds convincing and intelligent and says something that's just totally wrong. Well, there's a lot of groups out there that are putting out a lot of information that really isn't credible. Oftentimes, some of these seemingly knowledgeable organizations are funded by companies that are out there to make money. And one of these groups, maybe you've heard about them, is it's called the School Nutrition Association. Their website is schoolnutrition.org, and they've been putting out a lot of crazy stuff. So a great article, or a great few articles that have been coming out, I think are worth reading, is from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Their website is ucsusa.org, and they have a blog, which is at blog.ucsusa.org, Union of Concerned Scientists. They've been doing phenomenal work for decades. I really love their information. And they've been posting a lot of different excuses. That's what they're calling them, excuses from the School Nutrition Association. And the School Nutrition Association is actually for rolling back school food standards. Now, our government, in its very slow and painful way, has been working towards improving the school lunch program, improving the recommendations for kids, and there's been a lot of pushback. And a lot of the pushback is because of the food manufacturing organizations that don't want to make changes. It's hard to make changes, and they don't want to make the changes. They may be costly. And, you know, as Amelia was talking about earlier in the program, maybe when they make the changes, the food doesn't taste the same and the kids won't eat them. So there's a lot of interesting points that have been brought up, and they're really silly, by the School Nutrition Association, and I recommend that you check out some of them. Just kind of one of the popular ones is they say lowering sodium levels at schools may harm kids. Lowering sodium levels at schools may harm kids. Now, that's kind of ridiculous, I think. We know that it's the higher side. Higher sodium levels are really what the problem is. You could always add more sodium and salt to food if you don't think you have enough. Well, there's a lot more, and I recommend that you check out the Union of Concerned Scientists and their blog posts on the School Nutrition Association. And that's about it for today's It's All About Food. Thank you for listening, and I hope you're surviving this hot, humid heat if you're in the East Coast like I am. Otherwise, enjoy and have a very delicious week.